Okay, so good afternoon, Carl, and welcome to the Shared Value Conversations. This
Thank
is our
you.
second one, and really, really great for me personally to be here because it was created by Henley and by the Amalgamated Group, which is a group of students that's studying at Henley. So it's really great to welcome you with us, Carl. You know, I've been looking at your integrated report. I've looked at how successful the company has been. I mean, you're a heritage brand, a South African heritage brand, over 100. Yeah, I think you're 103 this year, or last year were you 103? Was it last year?
Yeah, so this year's
Yeah.
104.
Okay. So Carl, my name is Tiki Barnard. I know we haven't met, but we've been watching you. Don't worry about it. The Shared Value Africa Initiative has been watching you closely. So we a Pan-African organization. We work at the moment across 15 countries across Africa. And our mandate comes straight from Michael Porter and Mark Cramer, is that we've got to try and get all businesses, and that's the dream, to get all businesses on the Africa continent to one day practice creating shared value, because that is how we're really going to bring about change. But first, I want to tell everybody that's listening how well FBOP did last year. And I guess it was part of what was happening to us at the time. We have to understand that as well. But I thought, you know, I was looking at your AGM in November 2021. I mean, your premium income increased by 9.6% to 5.2 billion. New business annual premium income increased by 44.9% to 1.9 billion. So your total assets increased by 32.3% to 28.3 billion, which is absolutely amazing, Carl. So I always say to myself, when I look at how well organizations have done through COVID, will you be able to repeat that going forward?
From your lips to God's ears. No, Tiki, thank you. Thanks for having me, by the way. It's an absolute pleasure to be here with you guys and to share, you know, whatever we can from our side. Yes, last year, you're right, was a phenomenal year with some significant tailwinds. Again, you know, we're a multi-disciplinary, if you like, business or a group. We have our insurance practice or insurance business, which is the bulk of our activities, and then we have our funeral service offering, and we have a manufacturing business based in Bloemfontein. So across all three sectors or segments of the business, last year was an absolutely phenomenal year in terms of performance. But you know, again, Tiki, it's tinged with a little bit of realism and a sobering thought that, you know, each one of, you know, while we can talk about fantastic results, each one of those funerals that we conduct represents the loss for some family. And so it's not with a sense of pride or a sense of jubilation at all. I think it's just a sober reflection of what's happened in our economy throughout the COVID pandemic. And so we're humbled. We're very proud of our ability to be here to serve, you know, the country and to serve our society and our communities when they need us most. And I'm just glad that we were here at the time, you know, during COVID, that we could step up and I think really affirm our purpose in society, really, and provide the support that our members look to us for. So it was a year of exceptions in many ways.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, I think when I looked at your integrated report yesterday, actually, I spent about 3 hours on it, I have to confess, Carl. So it was good to see, and I guess it also created its own pressures as well, because I think that if you have a staff component and you look at that type of growth, how do you actually then, you know what I mean, staff up for that type of thing? But I think I want to bring us back to the reason why we here this afternoon, and ultimately we want to talk about the creation of shared value and why is it important for companies to really look at it. And I think, you know, whenever I ask you ask Mark Cramer or Michael Porter for the sort of academic definition of shared value, I asked Mark Cramer once to simplify it for me. So he said to me, you know what, Tiki, it is about creating economic value, and creating value for society and the environment in the environment as well. So Carl, I want to ask you this afternoon if you can maybe explain to us, because I think the differentiator from FBOP to its competitors, if you have any competitors. So is your mutual assurance society that sets you apart from everybody. So I want you to just firstly explain to us, you know, what the mutual assurance society model is like without giving away any secrets from a business perspective. And then to maybe just take us into why shared value, or how do you practice shared value within your organization? Carl, please.
Thanks, Tiki. So a mutual organization is an organization or the society that has no shareholders. So we have no external third-party shareholders investing in the business. What we have is an ownership structure where we are owned by our members. So the origins of AVBOB are way back in, 104 years ago, 1918, just in the wake of the Spanish flu, where a group of people got together, and because of the high cost of funerals and the economic hardships, they clubbed together to be able to support each other if there was a death in the family or within the group with financial contributions. And that concept at its essence is what still exists today on a rather larger scale. I think we have, 2.6 million members now, but each of them is effectively an owner in the business or has an ownership stake in the business. And so everything that we do within the organization, all the value that gets created in the organization is effectively for the benefit of those members. And so when we come to talking about the mutual model is distinct from other corporate models where you have shareholders and policyholders or customers that are diverse groups, where we don't have a diverse group. It's all the same bunch of people. And so that creates a very different dynamic within the organization. You can take decisions for different reasons. You can take decisions that are absolutely in the interests of the members or your customers because you don't have a third-party requirement that you need to satisfy. Mm. So, there's this dichotomy between profit and purpose that people talk about. How do you balance profit and purpose? In our structure, we don't have that distinction because it's the same group of people. So any profit that we make is specifically for the benefit of the people that we serve. So it's a bit of a closed loop, if you like. So yeah, that structure is quite unique in South Africa. I think there's only three or four mutuals left. It's well known and well established, internationally. But in South Africa, it tends to be quite in the formal segment. It's very rare. And that gives us the foundation for our concept of shared value.
Yeah, I think the only, I sort of looked yesterday at your competitors from that perspective as well to see, but you're 100% right, because there isn't a lot of them, the main that has this mutual assurance society. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your members and your policyholders. What is the difference between the two? Because I think I read somewhere that you can be, there's a difference between a policyholder and a member, from a business perspective. If you could maybe share with us a little bit what that is that's possible?
Sure. So the way we're structured is that I think it's about 99.9% of our policyholders are our members. There's a very small category of policyholders which do not qualify for membership, and those would be policies, for example, where the premium is payable for less than a year. Now, there's not very many of those. It's sort of rather old and sort of archaic at this stage, but for the most part, the members that are joining or the policyholders that are taking out policies now with us are all members of the society.
Okay, so Carl, I wanted to ask you because you talk a little bit now about profit with purpose, and I have to confess that's our mantra is profit with purpose from an organization perspective. And I think what for me, and I call it more than a tagline because that's what you've got is we here for you. Would you say that that is your purpose, or do you define your purpose differently?
Our purpose is to serve, I guess. Our purpose is to create value for our members. And so, that we're here for you applies on so many levels. It applies on the daily sort of level of when you need us, we're here for you. When an incident happens, we're here for you. But it also applies at the level of, we're here to create value and to return that value to you as well. So, that encapsulates, I think, our purpose very well, that catchphrase.
So, Carl, it reminds me a little bit about Safaricom in Kenya, who's one of our members as well. And I think that they also, like you, we're here for you. You can use that with everything. If something bad happens, we're here for you. If something good happens, we're here for you. If you need our help, we're here for you. So I think in a way, when Safaricom, their purpose was to transform lives. So in everything that they did, they always looked at how could they transform a life? How do they transform lives if they bring any product onto the market. A question for you from a your employee perspective, because I saw also yesterday in your integrated report that obviously a huge problem, with the onset of COVID is that your sales force couldn't do that face-to-face interaction with people out there. And that you had to come up with something to either help them as well from that perspective, but also to help your consumers as well from that perspective. And I know that digital, I think I can't remember what the figures were, but I think you did spend quite a lot of money on improving the digital side of the business. Can you maybe walk us a little bit through that so that we can just understand how the digital work and how did how long did it take to implement it? Because obviously there wasn't a lot of time.
Absolutely. No, I mean, COVID, the onset of COVID, I think, happened a lot quicker than anyone anticipated. And so it impacted us in a couple of ways. I think we saw the lockdown coming as it was announced. And I think we had 2 weeks to move our entire head office offsite. So, yeah, there was over 800 people working remotely within the space of 2 weeks. It was a little stressful, but credit where credit is due. The guys got stuck in, and we managed to get that up and running. And because we were an essential service, so we had to keep operating. We couldn't stop operating at all. You're right, Tiki, about the distribution, our distribution force, and our sales agents. There was a lot of noise in the market about it at the time, but we're here for the long term. We look through the cycle. And they are part of the family. A family is a big concept within AFBOB. And so we had to invest, is how we see it, in supporting them through that hard lockdown when they couldn't earn any income because they're commission-based earners. And that was right at the beginning of the pandemic. And I think the performance from last year is testament to how, if an organization is prepared to put people first, if you're prepared to invest in your people, they will return that effort and that investment with interest. And that's what we saw. We saw the amazing comeback and recovery in our distribution in the year following. So that was clearly, again, one of our values was putting people first. And so and that was clearly evidenced there. In terms of our funeral agents and reps, it was stressful, I'll be honest with you. They were working around the clock to try and serve people that were queuing out the door. So there we had all sorts of support mechanisms we put in place. There was counseling services. There was we had provided them with personal protective equipment, PPE for free that they could work completely protected in their environments. But it was tough. And I mean, again, a credit to them for their commitment and their passion. to serve, and to be there for people in their time of need, which is what we've always done, but had to take it to another level. So again, I think it's just the concept of family that we have, and our members are part of the family, and our staff are part of the family as well.
Yeah.
And when something happens in a family, you all get stuck in and help fix the problem, because, you know, that's what you do in family.
Yeah, I know, because you know what, Carl, I think that I think for me, what I'm hearing from you is that if you look at shared value, yeah. You know, I guess your model don't look at the shareholders. I mean, you look at the stakeholders. That's really who you're looking at, because that's, you know, when you look at the disciplines and principles of shared value, it's about the people. That's really what it is about. And I think that for me is what we often look at organizations to see from a principles and disciplines perspective, is that how do you look at your biggest asset, which is really your people? Because if you didn't have your people, how would they have, you know what I mean, step up to the plate? Because I think I saw also in your integrated report yesterday that you also, I don't know if it was during COVID, and you can correct me here if I'm wrong, that you opened 11 new, you know, offices. I mean, so clearly the demand was there, because we know what happened during COVID. And as you say, it is a little bit sad as well, but you provided the service that was so necessary for everybody that they wanted at the time, because that's the only thing you want to do is to give people dignity, you know what I mean, so that they can bury their loved ones. So what I want to ask you from a shared value perspective and your model, because we look at the framework of shared value, and I guess I'm a little bit of a purist, let me put it that way, because I think I always look at the first pillar, which is about reconceiving products and markets. So I think that in a way you do that from an FOP perspective, because I looked at your sort of product list that you have as well, and then we looked at the middle one, which is really, you know, building your supply chain, because if I look at all of the services that you supply, because I don't think that anything ever moves out of FBOP from, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you know, when you're handling a funeral, because you can do anything from the renting the car to the flowers to everything. Am I correct in making that assumption?
Partly. Let me put it this way. So yes, we will arrange everything for you. We will cover all of those aspects and potential requirements and needs. How we do that is, it's interesting. Our business model around funeral service is a quasi franchise model. What we do is we will provide, when we open up a new branch, what we do is we go in, we buy the building, we get the zoning rights, we do the refurbishment, the equipment, we provide vehicles, all the infrastructure that's required, the branding, etc. We then engage with an individual to come and run that branch.
Okay.
So we have a contract with that individual. That individual will then recruit their own staff from the community. They will then operate according to our standard operating practices. And there are certain services that we will provide as AVBOP, which we internally refer to as core services. That is the provision of the coffin and the service and the transportation, arranging of the service, et cetera, but then there are services that we will provide, which we internally say are non-core services, which the funeral agent themselves will procure from the community around their office. And that would be catering, family vehicles, et cetera. So really, the way we see our business model is that we are encouraging entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
Within the communities, we are allowing people to source their own suppliers on certain services, and on other services that we deem as critical, we will then provide the input and the guidance and the service ourselves. And I think that creates a fantastic sort of a balance between us being in the community and us not extracting value out of the community. We are creating opportunities within the community for people around us to participate in whatever activity we're doing there. And that's very important for us as an organization, that we want, wherever we are operating, we want that facility to be seen as a positive addition to the community, as something that's creating work, it's creating demand there in the community where it sits. And I think that's a key element of sustainability as well for us as an organization, that we encourage entrepreneurs, we encourage people to grow and to develop their own business model where we've provided all the infrastructure that they need. I think that gives them an accelerated sort of growth opportunity.
Yeah, I think what you're explaining now for me is what I was looking for to close that circle almost, because what you're doing indirectly is creating sustainable communities.
Yeah.
Because you're actually creating the employment within the community, and then hopefully, I mean, I'm sure that employment, affects so many other people in the community, and it has a ripple effect, because it wasn't coming through in your integrated report. That's my criticism, okay? so they need to tell the story better, because I sometimes think it's, for us from a shared value perspective, we're forever looking for case studies, because we need, because shared value, and I know I read in Trilog did an article that's also read that to say that you've been practicing shared value long before Michael and Mark actually came up with a concept, and I think that for me, that was what I wanted to hear, was that you do create those sustainable, sustainable communities. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, look, our major focus, I think for us, that's become just part of our operating model. It's how we work.
Yeah.
And so perhaps you're right. Perhaps we should give that more focus. I think for us, the focus has more been on our contribution back to our members in terms of delivering this value back, and how we give value back to our members in the form of sort of benefit enhancements, and free funeral benefits. I'm not sure if you're aware, you would have read of it, that every single one, we have policies that cover multiple lives, so like whole families. So we cover in total just over 8.5 million lives across the country. And as a mutual, we will provide a free funeral for every single one of those lives if they come to us for the funeral service. Clearly, there's a maximum limit on how much we're prepared to spend on that funeral, but every life covered will qualify for a free funeral. And that is a massive, massive benefit. And for me, one of the biggest inhibitors of capital growth or capital accumulation in a large portion of our population is the fact that the cost of providing funerals depletes capital. People will borrow money, they will cash to pay for a funeral. Now, this free funeral that we offer won't necessarily make people wealthy, but if it can stop them from getting into debt, they can at least get one foot in front of the next, and they can start on that journey of accumulation of some form of wealth or some form of value for themselves and then for their children and for the generations that follow. And I mean, that's a material benefit. In the last 2 years, I think we've contributed, or we've provided, nearly 800 million rands of free funeral services to our members. And that's 800 million rands that didn't have to get cashed in or borrowed or spent. It's money that we could, or value that we could, return to our members. And that for us is what we regard as shared value, or as that mutual benefit of sharing other value that we create back to the members.
Yeah.
And it goes far, far further than that, but I'll wait for the questions to come.
No. I love hearing, you talk, because I know I looked at, because it did say your key differentiator is being able to offer an integrated funeral insurance product and funeral services, to your members and policyholders. The other question I wanted to ask you is that from an employee perspective, because that's something that we always have struggle with, and I guess because the mutual assurance society model is sort of part of your ethos, is that we struggle seeing in organizations, big ones, that claim that they are practicing shared value, that the staff, doesn't have the same, I almost want to say the same values, because I also looked at your values as well, because you have customer focus, excellence, integrity, and people and teamwork, you know what I mean, as part of yours. So how do you entrench those values? Is there a training program that people have to go through before they sign up to join FBOP? Or how do you make sure that everybody's heart is in the right place? Because that's what I believe.
There isn't a specific training course on our values. Yes, we try and inculcate those values through how we work. I think for me, it's more about demonstrating the values than talking about the values. You need to get the message across. And so we communicate a lot with our staff. I have a monthly little video clip that I send out to our internal staff network talking about topics such as leadership, such as societal interventions, GBV, all the things that we're involved with as an organization, and the initiatives that we're involved with, to inform them, to let them know, so that they can be proud of what we're doing and as an organization, and be proud to belong to an organization that is making a meaningful difference. So there's the communication, and then there's the actual practice. It's how do you measure shared value? Well, you know, we tend to focus quite a lot on the actual quantifiable elements of that, rather than talking about the nice to have, you know, it's nice to be mm-hmm. inspired, et cetera, et cetera. We focus on actual value delivered. And that's through our interventions, either through the free funerals, through the additional benefits that we provide through our policies, but cash, tangible cash amounts to our members, through our interventions in education and literacy are a big, big focus for us as an organization. Mm-hmm. We've put a huge amount of capital behind that through our community interventions. So it's trying to just reinforce for our staff where this all goes, this mutual message, this mutual benefit and advantage, and trying to position it in a way to say that, you know, this is what we stand for as an organization. And as a member of this organization, you can be proud because you're a part of this. What you do directly contributes to what we're able to achieve. And I think it's not a quick fix. It takes a long time, but we've been here a long time. And I think we hope to be here for a long time more. And so it's all time to percolate through the system.
Yeah. I guess for us, what we've learned and what I've seen, you know, because our organization is, we were 4 years old this year because we were born on the 25th of May, in 2018, we officially launched the Shared Value Africa Initiative. So what we've seen though, Carl, it's about leadership. It really is about leadership. And I think for me, I spoke to somebody, to Ryan, who's the CEO of health at Discovery, and that was our first call that we had, and he was saying that Adrian Gore inspires him every single day. And I guess if you as a leader can do that to your people every single day, because we all need to have that sort of our reason for being. Why do we get up in the morning as individuals, as people? Because because we lose it if we get up every morning, you know, just to go to a job, you know, because it's got to be more than that. And that's what the feeling I get from a FBOP perspective, that it is more than that, because there's a lot of heartache within the job, and you also have to deal with people all the time, you know, so and it's a very sensitive issue that you deal with as well. So is there a special criteria when you employ people, or what do you look at, or what is the success model from an FBOP perspective for your resources, the people that work for you?
Look, it's there are two different faces to the business. The one is the insurance business, which is a sort of slightly more a commercial, if you like, type of environment where you're in a sales environment and you're fulfilling the obligations of your insurance business. The other is the funeral service, which is very, very much an empathetic service business. And there we are very careful when we select who we would appoint as a funeral agent, because in that environment, you're interacting with people at their most vulnerable time. Mm. If anyone's been through the loss of a close loved one, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about, where it's an unfamiliar experience, you're exposed, you're emotionally sensitive, and you need someone with a high EQ, with a high empathetic bent, if you like, who will come in and understand. And often, you know, emotions do run high. You pick up, you know, all sorts of family baggage and history that comes together at that focal point. And the funeral agent is more than just a person who is an undertaker. There are a counselor, a friend, they're a little bit of a psychologist. They are, you know, someone who is able to facilitate a very difficult and a very sensitive situation. And so we look for people with high empathy and high EQ sort of skills in that role, which is somewhat counterintuitive if you don't actually, if you're not part of the business or you haven't seen the business in action. So it is different, for the different.
So Carl, you mentioned education and literacy. You know what I mean? That's very, very important to have, Bob. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that? You know, what do you do from, how do you handle the education and the literacy side?
Absolutely. You know, we're struggling with an issue in the country of inclusive economic growth. Okay. Mm. And it's something that we have to deal with. And there are a number of, or I guess there's more than one ideology in terms of how you would achieve inclusive economic growth. But I think whichever method you choose to follow, all of them have as a common thread this question of quality education for our children and for our learners. Without that quality education, you do not have the platform on which to build that economic and that inclusive economic growth. And so for a number of years, we've been focusing on literacy and on education. We have a couple of projects that we've been running. We've invested, I think, over 150 million rands with the Department of Basic Education into schools infrastructure, a rebuilding and refurbishment. Yeah. That's been a fantastic project. It came to a close in July. We're now rolling into the sort of ablution facilities, the SAFE project, to provide appropriate sanitation and ablution facilities for schools. And that's an ongoing project that we have. I think currently we have about 30 million rands committed to that. And then the second project we've been involved with is to, through our factory in Bloemfontein, who can do just about anything, they've converted shipping containers into libraries. Yeah. So we can convert a container into a library with 3,000 books, a computer, seating area, ventilation, solar paneling, etc. And we install that at a school, at a primary school.
Yeah.
And I think we've done, each one of those is worth around 500,000 rands. We've done 58 so far, and we're going to keep rolling those out throughout the country. It's you know, our feedback and internal research that we've done shows that a couple of things. Firstly, that library not only is a resource for the school, it becomes a resource for the surrounding community as well. And then secondly, the schools that have received those libraries have shown a significant increase in academic performance following the library launch and the library donation. So we believe it's effective. You know, you can talk about literacy and numeracy. You know, my wife happens to be a high school maths teacher. And one of the biggest challenges she has is with second language English learners who struggle with the interpretation of the question rather than the actual mathematics of the question itself. And so literacy is at the core of all of that. And so we really are strongly committed to those container libraries. We've just done a competition now in partnership with Oxford University Press. They donated 86,000 books, and our factory manufactured 108 sort of trolley mobile mini libraries. And we asked the public through social media, the press and radio for nominations for schools to receive one of these 180 libraries. We had 5,562 responses, nominations, which just shows the need and the hunger for literacy and for materials that will help people improve in their literacy. So there's a huge demand there. And and so that's where we've been focusing, and we're going to keep focusing. Look, there are other initiatives, but those will
be. But I think it's, for me, what you know, from a library perspective, as you say, is that we don't, you know, we're on our cell phones. We, the more privileged ones, are on our cell phones all the time. But we need to look, we need to reach out to those, you know, that we can help to actually, you know, to almost foster that love for reading. You know, because I sometimes think, for me, that's a thing with the younger generation, Sechi, almost 100 in the shade. But, you know, with the younger generation, really, really great. And I love the fact that it also, it almost creates a bigger community, you know, with the library, library itself. I want to go back a little bit to inclusive economic growth. And I'll tell you what we did this year, because we, you know, gender-based violence is such a big problem in our country, and it's really, so we joined forces this year with the University of Johannesburg and with the University of Mid-Sweden, and we've just recently released at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange this report. We spoke to private sector. I'm not sure if Prof. Cornet from UJ might have interviewed you, or I don't know. I don't think so, but, you know, but we did interview some leadership, you know, quite a few of them, to find out what is the perception, you know, within the leadership on gender-based violence. Because for us, the big thing, Carl, is that gender equality. Now, I know I looked at your figures, and you employ, you know, quite a lot of women. I can't remember the exact percentages, but you do employ quite a lot of women. So for me, I almost want to ask, from a gender equality perspective, do you feel that AFBOP is where it should be, you know, from that perspective? And I think for me, and I also want to share a little few insights with you, is that we also did research, you know, I think it was in 2020, you know, where we looked at JSE listed companies on the financial services sector to have a look at the sort of mix, you know, where are they from a gender equality perspective? Because I think, you know, a McKinsey report in 2015 actually said that if we address gender inequality, and I'm not only talking about females, I'm talking about equal opportunities for everybody at work, we can add something like $12 trillion to the global GDP. You know, so for me, it's always interesting to hear from leadership. You know what I mean? What are your thoughts on that? You know, are you doing where you think you should be from that perspective? Do you think it affects your business? Doesn't it affect your business?
Tiki, absolutely. I mean, you can look at it, well, from my perspective, you know, we can look at it from a number of different angles. What is the right thing to do? What is the just thing to do? What is good for your business? And I think all of those things kind of converge into the same kind of messages. So, you know, as an organization, you talk about, you know, inclusive economic growth. As an organization, one of our big focuses is on inclusion.
Yeah.
Diversity is great, but without inclusion, it means nothing, and it's not going to you're not going to get the value and the potential unlocked out of your diversity. And that applies, you know, across all dimensions. And gender is one of them. So, you know, we employ 70% of our employees are women. 50% of our senior management, and I think by November it'll be 50% of the board are female. Now, that's great. Does that mean it's you know, we've achieved our target? Absolutely not, as far as I'm concerned. Unless those people feel like they are understood, they are seen, they are valued, and their contribution is received, then it's going to not mean much for us as an organization, and it won't mean much for them either. Mm-hmm. So, you know, while we may be doing well on the numbers, I think, you know, it's a gradual thing. It's a progressive thing where we uncover areas where perhaps we have a bias that we weren't aware of.
Yeah.
And I think the question is that as long as we as leadership are open to and willing to have a long, hard look at ourselves and accept that perhaps, you know, our policies are, you know, are prejudicial to one or other group in some sort of a way, and accept it, absorb it, change it, and improve and move forward, we're not going to get that inclusivity or that inclusion that we're looking for. You know, we have had our policies reviewed by independent experts to ensure that there's no bias, you know, age bias, gender bias, racial bias, you know, you name it. We've had them look at it and come in, but it's more than just the framework and the policy and the structure. It's how that is interpreted and run in practice. And there, again, it comes back to culture. It comes back to changing attitudes. It comes back to the example that the leadership sets in these things. you know, you talk about anti-gender-based violence, you know, we're very involved in that space as well. It's a societal issue. It's an issue that impacts on members of our staff. And again, with the family theme going in the background, we say, well, if something happens to you as a member of my family, it's my obligation to intervene and to help you. So with that in mind, we are involved with the Tears Foundation, for example, which has a Help at Your Fingertips helpline, yeah. Which is a toll-free number for any victims of gender-based violence or violence against children to find resources, to find to be directed to safe houses, to get counseling. I think we helped, I think, last year alone around 80,000 you know, victims of gender-based violence. It's a massive societal issue, and it's one that affects us deeply. And we need to be taking these issues seriously as a corporate, because if we really care for our employees, we need to be actively involved in the issues that impact on them in their daily lives, not just while they're in the office.
Yeah, Carl, that's like music to my ears, because I think it's about conscious leadership.
Yeah.
That's really, when you think about it, being conscious of what is happening out there, because I think the unconscious bias that you were just talking about here, from a cultural perspective, from what has society taught us, you know, how do we react to things? I think that's what we unconscious about. We're not conscious that it's happening to us when we make decisions or when we look at people. So for me, it's really great to hear, and I think that I think for me, when you look at it from a, I think you said you employ about 70% females, and I was giving you know, somebody an example the other day. If Tiki employs 15 females, five of those females in their lifetime is going to go through gender-based violence. It means that they can't operate at an optimum level at work. There is no ways that a person, you know, can do that. So it's really great to hear that you're conscious of it, you know what I mean, and you're doing. But the cultural thing is also a huge problem, as we know. You know, we started, and we know the Tears Foundation because we work with them as well. Because one of our initiatives that we started is the hashtag It's Not Okay GBV hashtag It's Not Okay movement, and that's where we, you know, that's under that umbrella that we released this research that we did, focusing on the private sector, because Prof. Cornet from UJ was saying there's a lot of research on gender-based violence everywhere, you know, but there was very, very little research about what the perceptions of the private sector is, you know, and do they think it's a problem to their business? Do they think it's not a problem to their business? But I'm sure you'll agree with me. It is, you know what I mean? It is a problem. So yeah. And so now I want to go, I want to get to the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Yes. And I think that for me, because gender equality is number five, so it's quite a, for us, it's a big focus area from that perspective. And I want to speak to you a little bit about from an environmental perspective, because I also had a look and to see what you are doing from an environmental perspective as well. So tell us a little bit about what you've done from your, I think you've got solar panels, you've, you know, at your offices, you actually off the grid, you know what I mean? And you're contributing to the grid. So it would be really nice to hear what you're doing there from an environmental perspective.
Thanks, Tiki. We are doing all of those things, as you say. I think for us, you know, the one project that might be slightly offbeat is the concept of what we call aquamation, which is an alternative to flame-based cremation.
Oh, yeah, I saw that, yeah.
Now, the topic may be a little sensitive for some, so, you know, warning. You know, flame-based cremation is an established and an accepted way of disposing treating, you know, a loved one once they've passed on. But it does have quite a significant environmental impact. And so what we've done is we've gone and sourced technology from the states that we brought over. We're the first ones in Africa to do it, which we term aquamation, which is a water-based technology using a high concentrate alkaline solution to accelerate the natural decomposition of the body. Mm. And so using that technology, we're able to conduct a cremation without the flame and the carbon emissions. I think it's about 10% of the carbon emissions or carbon impact of the traditional cremation sort of process. Now, we're not going to convince people, you know, who prefer natural burial to move across to cremation, but for those that are open to cremation and prefer an environmentally low impact option, we have the option available. And you would have seen that Archbishop Desmond Tutu, in fact, himself was acclimated instead of cremated when he passed away. So it's gaining recognition and gaining acceptance in society, and that's one way that we're trying to open up new options to people that are less environmentally harmful.
I think, Carl, when I hear you and when I saw that, because I didn't quite, you know what I mean, for me as a newbie and learning all about you, about AFOP, I couldn't quite understand it, but thank you for explaining it. And I guess when you're sitting in front of somebody, it's a way of giving them options, you know, at the end of the day. I think that's what we all want as people, and we want to feel that we've made the right decision for our loved ones. So a question I wanted to ask you, any plans of going into Africa?
Tiki, at this stage, no. We were, in fact, in Namibia for a number of years, and we exited from Namibia about 2 or 3 years ago. So at this stage, no. At this stage, in terms of our insurance and funeral service operations, we're looking locally. But in terms of our manufacturing operations, yes, by all means, we are looking at exports into our neighboring countries and up Africa, you know, wherever the market demands.
Yeah, I think Africa is not I've spoken to quite a few, you know, CEOs that's gone and come back, you know, so to speak. So and I've lost a lot in the process, you know what I mean? So it isn't an easy market, but I guess there are lots of opportunities out there Africa.
Yeah, and but I must also hasten to say, when we talk about Africa, we are part of Africa, you know.
Yeah, no, rest of Africa. Let me talk about the rest of Africa. Because whenever I speak to, because I'm now from a Discovery perspective, because Discovery is now going into the rest of Africa, so they're hoping to be in 12 countries, I think, by the end of this year. So, and I know I've always say Africa, but rest of Africa. You're quite right, and thank you for correcting me, because I keep on making that mistake. I wanted to ask you if you had no financial restrictions or anything like that, or a board that you had to answer to, like we all have to. Yeah. You know, what would your dream be for AFOP?
Tiki, on the topic of the board, we're very fortunate. I just must point it out that we have an amazing board, very supportive board, that are fully aligned with the purpose of the organization. So I think they're asking me the same question. And so where we want to be is in a society that is, or a business that is even more closely integrated into society, into the communities that we serve, that we're embedded, we're accepted, and we are an active and contributing member of those communities, rather than being a business that is present, you know, on site. So for me, the aim and the goal that we're moving to is closer communication with our members, closer integration of our member community, where we can interact with them, they can interact directly with us on an easily facilitated basis through technology or through whichever other platforms, and where we can on a regular basis now start to return this value that we're creating back to them, not just when they die in terms of a free or a discounted funeral, but while they're living, while they're active, while they're part of everyday life, that we can provide that value back to them in a tangible and meaningful way. So really it's a closer integration of ourselves and our members and the communities that they serve.
Yeah.
We serve, should I say.
Yeah. I think listening to you, I think there's a, There is another model here, Carl, when I listen to you, because I think if you, for me, when I think about how you're growing those sustainable communities, but wouldn't it be wonderful if all of the services could be supplied by the community itself? Because then you even, you know what I mean, your circle of sustainability becomes even far greater, you know what I mean, from that perspective. And maybe that is what is in your strategy, I hope, because from a shared value perspective. So, yeah.
So our ESD, our Enterprise and Supplier Development Program, does look at that. We do look at how we encourage our funeral agents in the various communities to source products and services from those around them and to create this sort of mini business, if you like, that they are the center of, where we facilitate, they do the business, and the community benefits, really.
Now, I would love to do research about that, because I think it would be really great. But also, Carl, I want to say to you that we want to, you know, we've got to talk, you and I, because I want FBOP to become part of our shared value voices, because this is what we always say, is that you need leadership. You need to use the voices of the leaders to influence those, because you do have a responsibility as an organization to influence those that hasn't taken the bold step. I know you've been at it for 103 years, but we need to influence other organizations to understand that they have a responsibility to contribute, you know, from a social impact and from an environmental impact perspective, you know. So,
it's true, though. But, I mean, you know, we can pitch it in many ways. Yes, there's a moral and an ethical imperative to get involved. There's a societal imperative to get involved. There's also a business imperative to get involved. Yeah. The well-known saying, you know, business cannot thrive in a society that's failing.
Yeah.
And from a sustainability perspective, I think as business, we have an obligation. We have to get involved through all those things. But if you don't subscribe to any of that, then purely from a sustainability perspective, you're obliged to get involved. We can't sit back and wait for someone else to sort out society's issues and challenges. Yeah. We need to actively get involved where we can with what we have and do our bit. And if everyone does their bit and stops waiting for someone else to do it, we will see this economy turn around. We will see South Africa thrive and prosper to the benefit of everyone.
Yeah, I think, Carl, I agree with you, because we can't wait. That for me is the thing. You cannot wait, and you can't wait for government. You can't wait for civil society. That's why I say, for me, when inevitably when you look at it, that the private sector are the ones that has the power, has the capacity, and has the resources to actually drive change. And for me, that's the thing from a shared value perspective that we want to do is to it's through voices like yours and through Safaricom and Discovery and all of those, is to try and drive that change, because here are credible organizations, you know, that is doing it. And that's a clear example that if you do the right thing, you know what I mean, that profit with purpose, you know, then you will create economic value. Because I think Mark Cramer always said, and I know we're almost out of time, but and I mean, we can talk the whole afternoon, I guess. But Mark Cramer said the first and foremost thing about creating shared value is to profitably address societal issues.
Yes.
And I think for me, when I look at the mutual assurance society model, it is about profitably addressing a societal issue, because it is an issue, you know, that you've looked at as an organization. So I want to ask you a last question sort of in closing, and I know it's been really great speaking to you, Carl. You know, I hope that this is not the last time that we talk, because I was thinking while you were saying, you know, you've got this quasi-franchise model, and, you know, we've also got the Shared Value Africa Academy, where we train young businesses on how to create shared value within their organizations as well. So for me, there are lots of things that we need to talk about, Carl. But last, for in closing, what I wanted to ask you is that if you had to give any advice to an organization, you know, I think about us, we work with young entrepreneurs. We've just finishing with a cohort now of about 20 of them. Oopsie, there goes my pen. About 20 of them that we take through this whole shared value. It's a 5-week course that they go through, and to try and get young businesses, you know, to practice shared value as well. But there are your mid-sized businesses that have been operating, because that's what everybody always say, oh, you know, we need to do an initiative because it can't be part of our strategy. Now, you have the luxury of it being part of your strategy, you know what I mean? But what advice would you give anybody that wants to start this journey of creating that profitably creating social impact where it really counts?
There could be any number, I guess, but my advice would be just start. Just with what you have, with where you are, it doesn't have to be a lot, but just start. Just do something. And the rest will come. It will evolve. It will grow. It will change course. But don't wait until you have it all figured out. Don't wait until your contribution you feel is significant enough or material enough to make a tangible difference. Just with whatever you have, just do something. Yeah. Just do something. And if you do something, if you take that first step on the journey, the next step will become clear and you can follow it. And you will then gain momentum and start to move. And you will find your impact does grow. It may start small, but it will definitely grow. So that would be my advice. Second piece of advice would be always put people first. Put people first, whatever you do. Look past the profit dynamic. Look past the business dynamic. Look at the people. And if you can understand and identify where they are and what they need, and if you can respond to that, you will have far greater impact than trying to get points on a score sheet somewhere. And it'll come back. What you sow will come back, I promise you. So, yeah, that's it.
So to everybody that's listening to Shared Value Conversations, those wise words came from Carl van der Riet, the CEO of FBOP. And what Carl was saying is that if you want to become a shared value organization, you need to make a start, which is the first thing. So take the step. And secondly, you need to put your people first. So, Carl, thank you very much for spending the last 45 minutes with me. We could have carried on for another 45 minutes, I'm sure. But thank you very, very much for being with us this afternoon on Shared Value Conversations.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Vicky. Thanks, everyone. I appreciate it.
Thank you.